You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss our episodes of TNG, the next. You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek, the Next Generation. And tonight's episode is Thine Own Self. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
I'm James from London.
And we also have
a guest.
We have a guest.
Introduce the guest, Lou. He's waiting to be introduced.
He's waiting to be introduced. Guest, introduce yourself.
I'm Chris from Carolina.
I'm sorry, Chris, you're going to have to be more specific.
I'm Chris, the large man from South Carolina.
See, there you go, South Carolina. Wait a second, I was thinking North Carolina, didn't I, James? I was wrong.
You're always wrong with this.
I always get that wrong.
Every single time.
Yes. Yes. Well, see, the problem is, Chris, I never had a teacher like you that made sure I knew what was north and what was south. So that's where that's at. And so how you been? It's been at least an episode or so since the last time we've talked.
Yeah, I mean, I went back and was able to listen to Sub Rosa that we recorded like a month ago. And that was fun. One of my favorite episodes. Just a fantastic, splendid little piece of business. And now I'm here for this.
Yeah.
I was here for their Harlequin romance, and now I'm here for Frankenstein.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's a little strange. I don't know about this one, but, you know, why Data's hair gets all messed up. I'm surprised Data doesn't have a program that would just straighten his own hair. But anyway. All right.
Lou, he got hit by a pickaxe. Of course his hair's going to be a bit messed up.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay, so Chris, you told me a little bit ago that you start school this Monday. So by the time you folks hear this, he would have already been teaching class for the last 2.5 months. What grade do you teach? Remind me.
I teach middle school.
Mm.
So it's 6th, 7th, and 8th in the States, for those of you who aren't from here.
Yes.
Or have a weird other thing, because I know different states do different things. Like, some do junior high, where it's like 7th and 8th and 9th, and some do... anyway, we won't get too far in the weeds. This is a Star Trek podcast, not an education one.
Well, I was going to say, if I remember when my daughter went through 6th, 7th, and 8th grade... 6th grade here was actually still in elementary, so they had 7th, 8th, and so I think it was 7th and 8th and maybe 9th, and then 10, 11, 12 in high school here. But if I remember, so 6th grade, probably they're still encourageable. You could still help them and guide them, teach them. 7th grade is when they start to get a little bit of the resistance to what you have to say. 8th grade is pretty much you know nothing and their friends know everything. And 9th grade, you're just the stupidest person that walked the face of the earth. Does that sound about right?
Well, that may have been true in your day, Lou. And by my experience, I find that 6th grade is where they are still a little bit sweet, starting to notice girls and relationships and things like that. 7th grade is where teacher dreams go to die. And 8th grade, they feel responsible and as though they have some... stake in the school because they're the leaders or the big dogs on the block.
That makes sense.
And then ninth grade, apparently they go back, they revert to their seventh grade insanity. So that has been my experience, that my sixth and eighth graders are sweet and great, and I love working with them. And then the seventh graders are quite full of themselves.
Well, then from my experience, it's exactly the way it was for me as well. Because you said sixth grade, they start getting into the interest in the girls and the opposite sex or whatever they're interested in. And the romance starts. And absolutely right. Sixth grade is the grade I fell in love in. So,
how old is that? What is it in terms of ages?
11 and 12.
That's weird.
Oh, God, yeah.
What's weird about it?
Sorry?
Yeah,
what's weird about it?
Yeah.
That's too young, right?
Oh, well.
No, I agree. My personal 11-year-old, who's never stepped foot in a school, is not interested in any of those things. She's still trying to, like, make loom carpets with her cousin, you know? But these kids are inundated with all these TV shows and romance and the Disney movies and everything else. And so, I mean, you know, it becomes a romantic picture in their mind. And when they get a little bit of freedom where they can stop in the middle of the hallways between classes, they're going to start having conversations and occasionally a hug might happen. And then by the end of the year, you're having to, like, make sure that there's a teacher around every corner so that no one is caught kissing. And then by eighth grade, it gets even worse. So, yeah.
Well, see, when I was in sixth grade, we were still in the same elementary. We went through eighth grade, kindergarten through eighth, and we had the same, you know, we didn't change classes. We were in the same class. And, you know, and that blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl that was usually just a couple rows away from me was everywhere we went, every grade we went, she was there with me. She was there to go. And yeah, absolutely. Fifth grade is late. Fifth is when I started noticing. Sixth grade, I was absolutely flat out deadly in love with this girl, and you know, and it just never went anywhere. And I, you know, I nothing I can do about that. It's done with now, and she's passed on. So, but yeah, I understand. But you know, sixth grade, yeah, they think they're in love. They're not. We're not. I don't think I really knew what I was talking about back then. It just, I liked being with her. I liked her near me. Call that love if you want. But, you know, today it's a whole different ball game. Why? Because of the stuff they see on TV. We didn't have this stuff that changes our perceptions of what love was. I just liked being near her. That to me was love. As I got older, it got deeper, but still, you know. Anyway, we're in a tangent we haven't been on for 5 minutes.
So, it is what we do, right?
It is what we do. Yeah, Colin hates that. Poor Colin. We do that to him. And I could just hear him go, ugh! But now we love it, Colin. So anyway, we got to thine own self. So, the synopsis for this episode is Data suffers amnesia in a primitive society while Troy applies for a promotion. This is the 16th episode of Season 7 of Star Trek The Next Generation. And I got to be honest about something. I didn't read that synopsis when I gave it a rating. It almost drops it by one full scale just reading that nonsense alone. 16th episode of Season 7, first aired on February 14th, Valentine's Day, 1994. Teleplay by Ronald D. Moore, story by Christopher Halton, and directed by Winrich Kobe. Let's see about guest stars. Ronnie Claire Edwards as Tolvar, Michael Rothar as Garvin, Kimberly Cullum as the cute little Gia, Michael Haggerty as Scrowen, and we're co-starring Andy Cosson as Apprentice. They put him as a guest star, but they don't give him a name, just Apprentice. Richard Ortega as Rainier, and of course, Majel Barrett as the voice of the computer. So, what do we think of this episode, Chris?
Sorry, my daughter was running. Unfortunately, today I have to play both dad and podcast guest because my wife is at a thing that she has not returned from yet. Mm-hmm. What did I think of this episode? You can cut all that out, Lou, though I know you won't. No. I thought that this episode is a standout episode to me for this season because it is coherent and good and involves all the people that I love. So I can't say anything necessarily bad about this episode. It sounds like we're gonna have some good conversation though.
I got a feeling. And you did say earlier that your kids did watch it, right?
They don't watch all the episodes, but I did cut this one on. I watched it last week because, spoiler, for all those inside baseball, I guess is what we'd call this. We were actually supposed to record this a week ago, and I failed. We had some stuff going on, and then I came down with some weird stomach illness, and I forgot all about the podcast, and you guys were gracious enough to let me make it up instead of going and recording it without me. So I had watched it for that, and then, a week goes by and you forget everything.
Well,
I was going to rewatch it today, but as I'm playing both father and caretaker, the kids were here, and when the TV's on, they're glued to it. So they watched it with me. And in fact, my girls halfway through the episode came in to get the little Deanna Troi action figures out of the bag. They have a bunch of Star Trek action figures in an old bag that they play with all the time. And so they had to come get the Deanna Troi action figures to watch the episode where Deanna, gets her comeuppance.
Well, they're certainly welcome to come on and give us their review of the episode.
Distracted at the movie.
All right. Well, if they come back, you can say, hey, why don't you tell the audience what you thought of the episode? And we'll give them their fair share of the royalties, okay? Right now, Chris is going, royalties? What royalties? Yeah, I know.
Well, James, a percentage of zero is still zero.
Absolutely. You get the most percentage of the zero, that is. You get the most. Okay, so cool. James, how about you? Oh, wait a minute. Did you even give us
Give you a what?
Did he just give us his... yeah, he did. Never mind.
I was talking about Chris.
Yes. Did he give us his initial thought? Actually, yes, he did. But then I went on a tangent. Go on.
Okay. So I am quite disturbed here, Lou, because I'm getting the sense here that you don't think that this is a 5-star perfect episode. And if that is where you're coming from, you're wrong. This episode is awesome. I think it's it's perfect from start to end. I showed this to my kids, who are not that well-versed in Trek, a couple of months ago, actually. It was that we watched a couple of episodes, and this is like a go-to. This is a great kind of, self-contained Data story that is just that displays everything that I love about Data. And also, there's a lot of stuff going on here, right? It's about... it's about the ostracized from society. It's about how you would welcome, people into your village. This is a great episode, absolutely wonderful. And I even like the Troi part. There's nothing wrong with the Troi part. It blends perfectly well. We end up, learning the lesson that if you want to get on in life, you have to order Geordi to his death, which is good. Mm. A good lesson you should learn as early as you can.
I agree.
Geordi must die.
Die horribly, in fact. No, actually, I do like the episode. I didn't like the synopsis. Okay. Data suffers amnesia in a primitive society while Troi applies for a promotion. That just kind of like... That test loses a point just for that alone. But no, this is a nice episode. It's a good episode. How many podcasts in any... that does reviews of any episodes of television or movies, how many have say the same thing? I hate the kid actors. The kid actors sucked. No, I some of the kid actors we've had are really good. And I like her too. She's the one that Data relies on. And so No, this is a good episode. It's, you know, five? I don't know. But hey, convince me.
Yeah, we will. Actually, we will by the end of this, I'm sure.
Okay. So, what have we got going on today? Well, we have Beverly, who's in command of the bridge. It was a night shift, wasn't it? And because Data wasn't there, she would get to command the bridge.
Mm-hmm. And yep. I love that little piece, you know? Like, so far this season, we've gotten some weird little bits of, like, just life on the ship. And I don't know that we've seen night shift before this, maybe in passing, but, like, this is a whole scene where the deck is obviously less populated and Beverly's in control and it's a little bit darker. The lights are a little muted. I just thought it was really interesting. You know, this along with like Lower Decks where you get to see some of the other guys that aren't featured. I really enjoyed this little just aspect as an aesthetic piece.
Okay. There is one thing I am curious about a couple things. One is, you know, you had said earlier, Deanna had to order Geordi to his death. In a simulation, we should mention, guys, because, yeah, we watched the same episode you did. So, but here's the thing. What about Crusher? How can a doctor order somebody to his death? Doesn't that break her Hippocratic oath to do no harm?
No.
What? She has to save lives, not take them. And that's exactly what she has to do. So Dr. Crusher ordered Geordi to his death? I can't see that even being possible for a doctor. That goes against everything that their medical ethics tell them they must be.
But this, so you're referring to the command test, and you're referring to the fact that what happens at the front of the front of the episode is that Troy comes back from a conference or from a reunion, and she's kind of, you know, having a bit of a midlife crisis, right? Thinking about her career, and you know, obviously Crusher's a full commander, whereas she's only lieutenant commander at this point. Now, I don't think that there's that much wrong with a doctor, or in this case Crusher, being able to operate in two modes, right? You know, just because she's a doctor doesn't mean that she can't kind of like switch that off and actually do, you know, actually kind of take command decisions and things like that. And also I'm going to back out of this analogy straight away, because she goes aboard a Borg ship. She shoots people with phasers. She has no problem doing harm to people, right? So, you know, if you're suggesting that a doctor is somehow, you know, pure in the sense that like a Vulcan can never tell a lie, I don't buy that.
Or a Klingon is honorable.
Yeah.
Okay. So did she actually go aboard a Borg ship and shoot her phaser and kill some Borg? I don't recall that. I remember everybody else. Well, she was just scanning tricorder for Picard or Locutus. I don't recall ever seeing...
She must have been handed a phaser, right? It's she...
She may have had one.
She's clearly had a phaser in the past, so I'm sure she's... sure she's shot a few people.
That is something I'm going to have to actually investigate into and look into. Did Dr. Crusher ever kill anyone? Without being self-defense, that might be different, though. I don't know. And maybe the, you know, I don't know if in the Hippocratic Oath that says the needs of the many are going to outweigh the needs of the few or the one. So, I mean, once she, you know, swears to never do harm, and that's curious. I just don't know how, if it can go into conflict. And the second thing is, the night shift. They're in space. Isn't every shift the night shift? I mean, other than the clock that starts at midnight and ends at 23:59 hours, it's all night. Why in the 24th century would they actually have shifts that matter day, swing, and night?
Well, I think the thing that they're saying here, right, it's the shift that Picard isn't awake for, regardless of what shift or what time it is. It's the B team.
Okay. Or the C team in this case.
Yeah.
All right.
But by the way, I just googled how old Marina Sirtis would have been at this point in her life, because I'm thinking that I just wanted to check that when I said midlife crisis, I wasn't being rude or anything like that, and I just realized that I'm older than what Troy is in this episode. You know, considering that I've watched this episode first as a 15-year-old, mm-hmm. I find that incredible. Time is indeed the fire in which we burn.
Yes, that is so true. Good God, is that true? Okay. All right. So Data's fetching a probe that crash landed on a planet, and when he got there, I'm a little unclear. What did the probe? Did the probe blow up on him, or was it radiation that came from the probe he couldn't handle? He just walks into this settlement or this colony, doesn't know who he is, doesn't know anything. He can read radioactive, but he doesn't know what that means. He can speak English. He could talk to these people without his comm badge. It just seemed like sometimes the Data doesn't know anything shtick is a little silly. That's one problem I have. It's hard for Brent. It had to be hard for him to walk in like he's a completely incompetent android who could still read but doesn't know what he's reading. Does that make sense?
No, okay, I hear what you're saying, but I'm going to really strongly push back against this, because
good.
I think this is one of the better scenes showing someone kind of recovering from something that obviously went bad, right? Mm-hmm. So the way when you see Data straight away and he can't talk or he's just making noises, and you see him slowly regaining a bit of his functionality, almost as if he hasn't quite started, booted up. I don't know whether it makes sense, and I don't know whether or not this is how it would happen. But I kind of feel that there's a certain truth here, as someone coming around after a big hit on the head. I like how he plays this. From the perspective, by the way, of Data, I don't think you can ever really argue that the universal translator is not working, kind of thing, because I've always assumed Data is intelligent enough to be able to speak any language or pick up any language extremely quickly. I'm not going to be annoyed for that one. I just love how bad Data looks and how he's kind of, us fans of the show obviously haven't seen him in this kind of condition. I think this is a good way of kicking off the episode.
Okay. So I don't know, maybe so much Data rebooting as maybe Data defragging. His defrag is in process. Until then, some processors are down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That could be. Okay. Chris, anything?
Do we really care? I mean, do we really care why he's this way? Or like, do we care that the episode is fun and interesting and deals with ideas?
Right. But, if we were to spend the whole show saying it was fun and good ideas and nothing wrong with it, we'd be done in 5 minutes, which I'm sure James would
right. Like. Right. No, that's for the ideas. But the thing about this episode that I think is really intriguing, and I actually bristle against it, even though I really love the episode because I kind of disagree with it, is the conversations that are had between like the doctor and Data at some point, where she's like, the old people used to think this, but we think this, and she's even wrong, because Data's even more advanced than she is. Like, so there's this whole like the stupidity of the past argument that they make in the middle of the episode, right? Like, that's the meat of it. Like, whether Data is for the 427th time defragging his braid, like, I just feel like those are the small potatoes thing that have to happen for a story to happen. You know what I mean? Like, we have to sometimes have the ship go on the fritz and like freak out, or we have to have the food replicators replicate
junk, because that's a story element that's going to cause issues that then lead to the big things that we want to talk about.
Right. That makes sense. And that doctor, she was hilarious. She was absolutely hilarious. We finally found somebody, a medical doctor who's more of a quack than Beverly is.
She, would we call her a healer? I don't know.
No, she's ridiculous. She must have really, really bad insurance premiums for malpractice, because she is absolutely terrible.
No, but hang on. Well, what's everyone got against the doctor? I think the doctor.
I don't have anything against the doctor herself.
Oh, I don't have anything against her. She's hilarious. She's actually funny. But if you were you, would you really go to her for a medical issue? That I would never.
That's fine, right? Like that. So she is doing the best with what she has at her time.
Yes. Yes. Like, yes.
And the thing that I hate is that they wrote her to be completely stupid.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So she's not completely stupid. That's unfair. I'm going too far to state my point. But they do a lot in the episode to make her hypocritical. So she talks out about superstition, but then she uses unempirical arguments, which, by the way, Data's little analogical reasoning, his whole thing about, well, that's analogical and you can't blah, 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 right? So she made a false analogy. But analogical reasoning is how we've gotten a lot of the scientific breakthroughs that we've gotten, you know, so you start with the analogical reasoning and then you have to go and prove it right empirically. And if it doesn't prove empirically, well, that was a false analogy. Throw that one out with the bathwater. Right. And the writer's assumption that this woman wouldn't do that kind of work as a scientist and a doctor in her day was what I kind of bristled against, because I feel like she would have at least been doing that. She would have had more of an answer for Data than just like, ooh, you know, stodgy, like, how dare you question me kind of thing. So it was more her reaction as a scientist of her time that I felt like was unfair. You know, she may not have had all the answers that Data had, and she certainly wouldn't based on, you know, the time frame of what they were trying to make this be. But why do they make her kind of, why did they make her so bad about it, right? But I think she is a woman of her time in a lot of ways in the way that they wrote her. But I just feel like the writer's hand showed a little bit there, and it bugged me. That's what makes it not a 5-star episode for me, but it's very close to.
Yeah. Well, what it seemed like to me was that she couldn't use the words, I don't know, except for she did one time. Until that time, she says, I don't know. But then she went right back into her old shtick and just said, okay, well, this is what it must be. And Iceman? What? We got to know what an Iceman is to understand why she's calling Data an Iceman.
But no, hang on. I'm not as down on this particular character and how she uses her scientific reasoning. Now, she's clearly what it. She's clearly a product of the time. And Data is clearly an android from the 24th century who kind of knows more stuff. I honestly thought that the, okay, yes, she's not a pure advocate of the scientific method. You know, I think that is clear. She, you know, she's not coming here and she's not, she's not trying to, she's not being held up as, you know, the purity of that. I think to a certain extent, maybe Data is, and they probably needed someone to kind of, for Data to bounce off of. But having said that, she's not just sitting there and spouting dogma, right? The issue about the Iceman, she's reasoning that it must be the case because he's very strong, and they must have monsters up in the mountains, kind of things, and it's all kind of reasonable, and I appreciate when people mention about, okay, well, you know, she's very hard on the old superstitions, but then she's kind of introducing a whole lot of new superstitions herself and not actually providing a huge amount of explanation of to her kind of, you know, of her view of the world or her model of the world, but I never kind of felt that she was particularly kind of like, anti-science. You know, it might be something from, if we go back in our age, it would go back to, you know, probably, you know, way back, right? It's kind of a, you know, pre-Enlightenment kind of ages in Europe. But I don't feel that she's kind of, you know, anti-science or dogmatic in her approach. She's just of her time.
Misinformed. No, I said she was a great character.
It's not that she's misinformed, right? And Doc, I actually agree with you on that point. I think the point that I'm making is a little bit different. I don't dislike the character because of that, right? I think that she is as informed as she should be, and she is a representative sample of what you might have found if you actually went to a medieval place, you know. And of course, she couldn't be empirical or purely scientific. I can't remember the exact wording you used there. The purity of the scientific method, right? I think was the term you used. Of course, she couldn't have that because it's pre-Enlightenment, right? It's medieval. But my problem there is the writers really show their hand, and I kind of disagree with the idea of there being even a purity of the scientific method. I think it's always messy every single time, right? And we seek to make it less messy. We seek to define it, but ultimately you still have gravity where we have to talk about stickiness or whatever it is, right? Like there are things that we can't explain. And we've had this conversation, right, on prior episodes, where I am more okay with the writers not imposing this, like this thing is perfect and there's a much better way than you're doing it. I think this lady got as far as she could get. And I actually liked the character as written. I just hate some of the ways that the writers tried to shoehorn in some of their own biases towards empiricism as a perfect model, because we both know that it's not exactly perfect, and we're seeking perfection, right? But it's not exactly perfect. And there was some of that in there. There was like the I'm greater kind of
stuff. So are you kind of referring to that? I mean, I know that there's a scene when she's teaching, she's teaching the class and Data's in with the class. And she mentions that okay, everything has, you know, I don't know whether it was earth, water, air, fire, whatever it would have been. And she was, right, you know, telling you things like, okay, you can feel the earth by how heavy it is. And you know, Data then puts up his hand and it's like, no, I don't think so. I think, you know, what you're really, yeah. I think he does make a reference to like, you know, does he not make a reference to like subatomic particles or some kind of you know, a more advanced description of matter than I do believe that Data would have been aware of, because at this point he really wasn't you know, he wasn't fully functional. He didn't have his memory. He didn't have a lot of the learning.
But the problem for me was that like he's attacking her and saying your reasoning is fallacious, but it is her reasoning is where it should be, right? Like her reasoning is what it can be at that time.
No, and I do have to say, I think that particular scene is a bit, it is a bit corny, because it is that someone's, you know, if you take that scene as someone ridiculing someone out of time and basically saying, look, whatever, you're no better than the old superstitions, and we now have it correct, as in this is the way things are actually, I think that's, you know, that is not true, and I think that's unfortunate if that's the way that kind of exchange gets perceived. I kind of hope that wasn't the intention of the writers. I agree that it kind of it skates quite close to being slightly condescending, and I don't like it when I don't like it when there's this suggestion that certainly, you know, we've got all the answers, or we've got kind of like a perfect understanding of the world, or anything like that, because that's just completely not true. If you know, the more kind of like broad question about whether or not like the quote unquote scientific method, so the philosophy behind how you demonstrate, prove things, you know, to the extent that people want to argue with that, I think that's a more more abstract point that you probably wouldn't be able to drop into Star Trek even, but I think I hear what you're saying on that exchange, especially at the school, because I think that's the one bit where I don't think it would have harmed Data not to kind of like talk back at her, right? That there's no reason for that kind of exchange other than to, you know, I'm going to use an inverted commas here, or you know, quotation marks, to show her up as not being correct.
And I don't think I would have had that same feeling if she hadn't have been so haughty in her statement about, we don't believe in those old superstitions, right? Like, we would have thought you a monster, but we don't believe in those old superstitions.
Well,
they're also playing with the Frankenstein story. Like, this was, I think that this was supposed to be a treatment of Frankenstein in some way. You know, he is the monster that comes to town, and they're trying to do the Star Trek version of that, right? And so I just feel like they're seeding some little things in. So I did take it that way because of those reasons. The way that you said it,
so, charitable. So what I actually like, and what I kind of I do see in this episode, and I might be just completely wrong, which is that you know, science isn't it isn't like a level you get to. You don't do a quantum leap up to like perfect scientific understanding. It is always kind of it's a gradual process, and it is. The thing that I liked about this is that at least this woman was attempting to demonstrate that even in the most primitive cultures, and this isn't really that primitive, by the way, you know, it's not as if they're that cavemen or anything. They make clothes and they talk and they have, you know, that they're clearly building weapons and things. So it's not that. They also have centralized water. So it gives you an indication of that pretty advanced in terms of a civilization. Although obviously they don't have Wi-Fi, but I like the fact that it kind of shows you that even in these circumstances, which is a relatively primitive setup, you still have people doing science. And I don't think that they're trying to like belittle these people as doing like, you know, bad science or dummy science or baby science or anything. I do feel like it should be considered as proper science, you know, on its way to eventually, you know, however far you can push it. I like the fact that it's not just a crazy witch doctor with superstition. Some, I think in the original series, right, they've had cases where you beam down and there'll be like, you know, one wise old sage that will have some sort of supernatural powers of understanding things. But this is someone that is at least showing some degree of kind of scientific understanding with logical reasoning and at least an inkling to like, you know, move things forward and to kind of push forward the boundaries of understanding.
Yeah. And I mean, so with the original Star Trek, I think they definitely look down the nose a lot more at old history, right? But if we're talking medieval times, we're talking in a time where, yes, they had bad ideas, bloodletting and other things, right? But they still understand what they're seeking after, like seeking after the galaxies, even though the Catholic Church was sometimes fighting them on, you know, heliocentric versus geocentric or whatever. Like, they were constantly progressing that conversation, sometimes through wars, but often, you know, through this bumbling progression. And that's what I love about science, is that it's so humble. And we live in a time right now where I feel like science is not, the humility is lost because people feel like the humility can't be there, or people will get the wrong idea. So the media message has to be perfect. But then when it's perfect, it's so much easier to see where, hey, that wasn't 100% correct. And we're not really looking at the data at all. Like, or we were looking at the data, but we're trying to suppress parts of the data because it doesn't fully fit whatever narrative we're trying to drive, right? But science, for all time, has been this thing where we're kind of bungling along and then finding things in sometimes the strangest of ways, right? Like, sometimes we've had scientific advancements through dreams and through various other measures that you just wouldn't expect for some crazy scientific advancement to happen. And so there's an inherent humility that I think that has to be behind whatever science ends up becoming as proven as we can prove it, right? And I just thought that this was a strange place where Next Gen was looking down the nose at this lady. And I don't think I would have felt that way if they hadn't done the double whammy of they're superstitious, no, you're superstitious kind of thing, is what it felt like to me as I was watching the episode. But that's fair. I also appreciate that they showed this where there are seekers, because that's true to life. There were seekers. Like, I just read a book by Clement of Alexandria, who wrote in 200 AD, right? And this guy's writing about the atmosphere and comets and shooting stars. So he has a delineation between shooting stars and comets, right? He knows about atmosphere and is able to recognize that a comet and a shooting star have atmospheres, right? And that that somehow does something to them. Now, he can't explain it the way that we can explain it today, but like, this is 200 AD that we're talking, you know, thousands of years ago, and people were seeking after these things. That's like pre-medieval even, right? So I just think it's good. You're right to see that and see that as a good, and I should have probably been charitable and seen the good of it and not just the here they go again kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I think that's all kind of fair comment. I want to pick one thing up, which is that I do think that there is a bit of a problem with the public perception of science these days, or at least I fear that there is a problem, and I'm not entirely sure how kind of it is seen kind of outside of the academic world or outside of, you know, in the layman's world. There are always open questions in science, and there are always kind of uncertainties, and there are always also kind of like, you know certain things with absolute certainty, but in order to get those things known, you have to kind of frame the question in a very scientific way, or a very clear terminology. And I think I actually mentioned about the heliocentric model a little while back. So basically what we're talking about is that, you know, hey, does the Earth go around the Sun, or does the Sun go around the Earth? And the thing that I'm always I'm actually kind of interested in these arguments probably more than I should be, because given the way that, you know, in particular Facebook and YouTube work, is that they are fountains of I'm not going to use the word misinformation, but there are fountains of, you know, certain kind of ideas that people are engaged with, which generally means it's very easy to go down rabbit holes. And a couple of years ago, I kind of spent time, because there had been so much talk about, the resurgence in the flat Earth movement and stuff, as to, okay, what exactly do they think, and where is any of this coming from? The thing is that in some cases, and certainly not all, but in some cases, some of the things they were latching onto were slight there were misunderstandings of science or scientific terminology based on not quite having a full understanding of what is meant by certain words. And what we're talking about here is, you know, if you are talking about whether or not the Earth goes around the Sun or the Sun goes around the Earth, well, the truth of the matter is that they both orbit around the very center of the system that they happen to be formed part of, which happens to be way inside the Sun, rather than anywhere, you know, anywhere in between, or certainly not on the Earth. People often would then start referring to things like, well, but if you've got an infinite universe, then how can you define, what exactly do you mean by center, and what do you exactly mean by rotation, and things like that. And I do wonder whether or not I wonder whether or not we're kind of doing as good as we can at making sure that people are kind of scientifically literate in terms of kind of understanding some of these ideas and the concepts. Anyway, that was a stupid tangent for no reason.
No, I love that tangent, actually, because it's the thing that I've been thinking about lately. And honestly, like, we're using that model because it's I use that example because it's so far from us. Right. When both of us know that the secret thing that we're not saying out loud is that the real thing that we would like to talk about is the misinformation around like viruses and virology and COVID-19 specifically, and vaccines. And, you know, there's these whole lines of thought out there, right, about what is this vaccine a vaccine defined as we've defined vaccines for 100 years now? Or is it slightly different? And does that matter? And is it efficacious? Well, we have millions of data points to say that it's pretty efficacious, right? So, like, how do you then talk about that thing? Because that's really what we want to get at. That's a thing that, like, on the scale of things, flat earthers don't matter that much. And whether we are heliocentric or geocentric isn't going to change daily life that much, right? It's just a weird thing where it's like, we have pictures, we have video evidence, we have so many things that show that we're not flat, like, and that this model actually is pretty close to accurate, or as close to accurate as we can get without, you know, mapping it all out, right? And actually going to these places. So that is like way up on the list of like things that are just heady and interesting, maybe as an interest. But viruses on the ground level, like, this is a thing that really does matter. And science, people being scientifically literate and having a proper view of these things is important, right? On that virus level, on a thing that's actually affecting our daily lives and potentially causing huge disruptions to our lives, right? And I think you're right. We do need... We need, first of all, I think that humility. And second of all, I think that we need people who are clearly stating facts and can hand out those, like, here are the studies. Here's what they actually say. We need more studies in this area, right? Like, I feel like that is much more effective than some of the ways, especially in America, that we've had where it's like, hey, we're doing this thing because science says so. Okay, well, okay, I trust you. I want to trust you. Where's the science? You know, like last year around this time, we were told, hey, don't worry about masks because science says masks don't work. Right. And then, you know, a bunch of people were like, hold on, wait, masks definitely work. Like, we know masks work, certain masks at least. What are you talking about? And then we find out a few months later that there was no science that said that. And so then there's no humility. There was just like this fear that instead of saying the fear out loud, like, don't make a run on these masks. In fact, we're grabbing as many of them as we can to give to doctors because they need them more than you. Right. But like, masks could help slow this. Right. And just that little bit of humility and that little bit of honesty. And like, we're looking into other types of masks to see if they're actually effective around this or not. And it turns out they were. And so it's like, but I don't want to dig too deep into that. I know that this is a huge tangent at this point, and Colin's ripping his hair out listening to us. Like, we'll get back to data. But yeah, I agree. To all that to say, Doc, I agree with you, and I absolutely want to see that because I love science, and I think that as a method, science has given us some amazing things, and I would love to see the populace at large have a better understanding of science and be able to engage with these ideas, actually take the time to engage with these ideas. Like, I wish we could turn it into a sitcom or whatever people watch these days.
Okay. I'm going to pick up that baton for the tangent, and I'm going to run. And actually, I'm not necessarily going to apologize about any of this. Over the last year, there's obviously been a lot of pressure put on various governments around the world in order to get a coherent response to the pandemic. And I'm going to speak for my own country here and say that no single person in government has any scientific qualifications in any way whatsoever. They have never read a scientific document. They've never written a scientific document. They have never studied science beyond age 15 or 16 or 18, whatever it would have been. They do not have any, you know, they are not part of that world. I'm not part of the world which is Olympic caliber high jumpers. And that's something that I'm not, and I can't do that. These guys are not scientists, and they can't do that. And you can tell by the way how they, but what has happened is that we've required policymakers to be very, to get up to speed very quickly. And I think that certainly in this country, the failure of that has been, to me at least, has been jaw-dropping. Just the inability for people to recognize that they really have nothing to add to the situation, need to step back and effectively defer decisions elsewhere. But I have to say that one of the things that has come out over the last year is that, you know, as you've been required to make certain political decisions, and what political decisions are really is given A and B, and a cost of A and a benefit of A and a cost of B and a benefit of B, what do you prioritize? And that's how I would always sum up politics, right? You know, you can do something, there's a cost of it, and there's a benefit of it, and you know, you have to weigh them up, and you have to weigh it up based on whatever you feel is the appropriate thing. If you want to weigh it up surely based on purely based on, you know, the amount of damage it may or may not do to the economy, or if you want to if you simply want to weigh it up according to which one is alphabetical, you can. And you can have these, you know, these philosophies of government, and that's fine. But what we've had in the UK is that, and I think that this is really dangerous, and I don't know how much this mirrors the US, by the way, because I'm not really following, but we've had this term that's become parroted by government and government ministers whenever they get into a bit of a tricky situation and having to defend their political decisions, which is, quote, we were following the science, unquote. And yeah, anyone with any scientific background, knowledge, experience would shudder at hearing that kind of statement, because that's not that is not it actually does a disservice to the scientific method, to the scientists kind of even putting forward kind of the ideas. The you can't just shut down arguments in the political sphere by shouts, by saying we are following the science. And this is often also accompanied by this idea of we are following the science, shut up. And then, do you mind publishing the evidence? No. And no scientist in the world would ever even contemplate making decisions without peer-reviewed, published data. It just completely goes against whatever, you know, what you're taught as being the appropriate way to extend, you know, the knowledge throughout throughout the sciences. And we've had this, yeah, we've had a really, I think it's been a real, real bad time. And I worry that the we are following the science, I worry that that statement that has provided so much cover for, hey, potentially correct decisions, potentially bad decisions, I worry that that's actually polluted or has become, has become something that people are willing to argue about in terms of, you know, black versus white. And that's not what it ever should be. You should have to.
It didn't just start now, right? Like science has been fighting this battle with journalism for a long time, right? Science journalism has always been like fat causes heart disease. Well, yes, the study kind of said that, but like, not all fat. Like, we didn't test all these. Like, you're overstating the case, kind of, right?
Yeah, or sure.
Whatever else it is. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I don't think. I mean, so that is true, and certainly you've had, you know, you've had things in the past where you'll have a study, and the study might show that there's a potential correlation between X and Y, and they might publish that. And in particular, you know, on medical issues or on health issues, right? You'll say, you'll publish things saying, hey, you know, having three glasses of wine are going to make you live longer. Oh, now it's bacon's going to make you live longer. Now it's bacon's going to kill you. That kind of stuff does come up a lot, and I think that the press are very quick to run. Now, in the UK, we have national press that is very obsessed by this kind of, for want of a better word, clickbaity kind of stories. Mm-hmm. But the worry that I have is that this is the first time in my life, at least, that I've seen this kind of that this has been adopted by government as part of messaging. And that's something that hasn't happened so far. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when you realize that the newspaper that has been telling you that drinking two glasses of wine will extend your life, and then the following week publish two glasses of wine is going to cut your life expectancy, you know, you kind of go, well, it's just a junk paper, right? You move on. My mm-hmm. worry is that when it enters into the political world, and in particular is being used for political cover, right, and that being very fast and loose with the extent that they're backing onto this, you know, quote-unquote science, I worry that it tarnishes science more than just what the newspapers would do ordinarily.
Yeah, and over here it has become, the political divide has become the difference between we are going to put in these measures or we're not going to put in these measures. That's kind of what it's come down to at this point. You know, at first everybody was kind of on board with the same thing, right? Everybody was like, we're all going to just follow the federal mandate and that's it. And now we have, you can tell the difference between Republican and Democrat states by whether the governor is going to put into law a mandate based around whatever it is, right? Like, oh, the numbers are rising, we're going to now shut down, need masks, the whole nine, everybody needs to be vaccinated. Like,
like these are the conversation pieces that happened in over that are happening over here. And now like passports, that's another thing that's come up. So like everybody's kind of on edge, you know, it's kind of a strange, time. And the one thing that I haven't heard at all and from anybody, right, is everybody's saying vaccine, vaccine, vaccine in this particular instance. And the conversation around what natural immunity actually provides you and what it actually protects you against and whether you need to have the vaccine, like that hasn't entered into the conversation at all. But that's a thing that would have always been a consideration before this year. And so to a guy like me who pays attention to a lot of these things and has been paying attention to them even before we had COVID-19, right? Like, that's a question that kind of picks at the back of my brain. And I'm not a scientist, right? So when I'm looking for those people that are talking, they're talking about those big double blind studies that are talking about massive amounts of people who were put through these studies and what they're checking for and viral loads and the ability of your body to produce these spike proteins and how long that lasts, right? Or produce the what's the word I'm looking for there, Doc?
What, the antibodies?
The antibodies, thank you. My brain totally shut down, teaching me humility within myself. But like, those are conversation pieces that have been had around big viruses like this for a long time, right? Like, once you've had it, if you survive, you have a pretty robust immune system against that in the future. But then the variant conversation comes in, right? Which is intriguing, right? And I haven't seen a lot of the... I've read a couple of papers recently about a Brazilian variant and the Delta variant and how it reacts and interacts with people who had the first strain, the original strain that was going around. And of course, there were more than just the one strain, the one that hit my area that I actually caught, right? So this, to me, there's multiple layers to this. There's like an interest that I've had for a while that I've kind of tertiarily dealt with. The fact that I'm not a scientist and so can't say anything for sure, that I'm being pushed by politicians for this particular thing, and that there has been an erosion, like you're talking about, within my brain of like, I don't know that I trust what these people say about it. Like, I trust, in general, the concept of testing things and using data to make decisions. Like, I definitely trust that, right? But I want to see the data. Like, I want to actually hear from the experts. And it seems like every given expert is beholden to some person or ideology. And you have to like parse that out as well. And it becomes so confusing that you just get frustrated as a layman like myself. So I feel that very deeply in my soul, Doc.
Yeah, no. And it is a tricky situation. I think that to a large extent, by the way, that, you know, people, there are a lot of things that people just don't know, really. Now, that doesn't mean that there's significant risk, but certainly people are operating. When I say significant risk, it's the kind of risk that most people would take and be happy to take. So, you know, getting on an aeroplane, you know, walking across the street, having, you know, being slightly overweight, the kind of risk that everyone is happy to run in all cases. But it does indeed change when you're being told that potentially, you know, you should be taking this risk for the benefit of the wider society. And it also changes when you are forced to take it as a for the benefit of the wider society. And these things have, you know, where it's actually sometimes interesting to look at the kind of the behavioral science, which by the way, I'm going to put science in quotation marks around that statement. It's not a proper science, but the behavioral quote unquote science around the idea of, you know, what can you do to incentivize, and, you know, whether or not incentivizing people just makes people more suspicious about what you're trying to do.
Offering baseball tickets and $100 bills, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't, like, that, who is that actually pulling it?
Yeah, there was a study done a decade or more ago, and they asked people, I can't remember whether it was here or whether, I think it was in Switzerland, if anywhere. But they asked them, would you be happy to take, some, to build like a nuclear waste storage plant nearby your house, like 20 miles away. And it was like, you know, they came up with a certain percentage of people that were happy versus unhappy. And then they said, well, what about if we gave you $10,000 for that? And then at that point, like the numbers being happy with it plummet, because immediately you think, what are you trying to get me to do? What are you trying to get me to agree to here?
What are the risks?
Yeah. But I think in these cases, by the way, it's, you know, people really do need to be open with both what they know, what they don't know, and be just very, very open and honest about what the discussion is. And there can be, you know, there will be political decisions taken around things. And just to be clear, you know, I have no problem with people making political decisions. If the statement is that if you wear a mask, there, you know, there's like 15% less infections, and your ideology is that that doesn't bother you to the extent that wearing the mask bothers you, or to the extent that wearing the mask might slow down the economy, or is a hassle, or whatever, or is insignificant in the great scheme of things, then it's fine. But I think that you need to have as much out on the table as possible, and the thing I started off this discussion with is that you can't just say we're following the science, shut up and do it, because that does not get you any very far at all. And unfortunately, we've just had something in the UK where in the UK we're not going to be vaccinating under 18s. They're not part of the vaccination program, and we've got a committee that decides these things, and they've looked at the data. I know that there are a lot of people in the US that are vaccinating, you know, teenagers, and France is vaccinating teenagers, and there's a lot of data about whether or not it does more harm than good, or whatever it happens to be. And then obviously you have to consider the fact that for COVID, you don't particularly have, at least statistically, a significant amount of damage caused by, you know, teenagers getting this illness. Now, of course, asterisks on that, I'm talking statistically, there will be cases that will be horrendous that people have lived through.
And there's a statistical, like, if the statistic is 0.001% and you're talking about a billion people, that's still a lot of cases.
Absolutely. But the biggest problem with the decision that kind of goes against what the US are doing and what most of Europe is doing is that they're not prepared to publish their thoughts on it. That they've come up with policy, but they're not prepared to write up a document to say we have made this following decision. And that's where things get bad, right?
Well, it almost seems cowardly. Like, why wouldn't you? If you came to this decision, tell us why. Show us why you came to this decision. And then, you know, there will be critiques. Obviously, there's critiques to everything, man. Our review of this episode today will have critiques, right? Like,
what episode? What are you talking about? Okay, Luke, take us away. Let's get back on track.
I have no idea where we were, but honestly, that was a pretty damn good back and forth. I liked it.
We weren't very far.
No, we weren't. No, we weren't.
Well, we jumped ahead to a couple of scenes there with Data and the woman, the doctor woman.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that, you know, you guys mentioned was I noticed that she said rock, fire, sky, and water are the basic elements of the universe. And then I saw as she turned, the camera turns, and you see children in their desks. And I thought, gee, Chris, what do you think about her as the village doctor and now the village teacher teaching everything that is completely wrong? But you guys already mentioned that, you know, Data shouldn't have corrected her in the classroom. But is she really doing these kids any good with all these?
I think she probably is, right? Like, if that conventional wisdom moves them forward in their society in whatever way they need to be moved forward. So he specifically said that's analogical, and you're taking the analogy and you're extrapolating it too far. So the argument that I would have is that at some point, some kid is going to question the analogy that she had. Like, yes, my teacher told me this in second grade or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, my teacher told me we were geocentric in second grade. I'm going to go back to that example. But I'm not sure about that. And when I look at this, it seems to indicate that we're actually the ones going around, right? Or that we're the ones that are dealing with this particular element, for instance, right? I don't think that everything has to be perfect that's taught in the classroom. And in fact, it can't be, right? Like, yes, we've settled certain things, and we should be teaching the settled things first. You know, 2 + 2 = 4. Except,
hey, that's not that's not a
right.
I'm not going to take the bait. I'll take the bait.
It doesn't.
No. Okay. So the issue here is that So math is a very, very, very unusual subject.
Right.
And what maths is, it's not about the world we live in. It's about abstraction, and it's very carefully defined, and it's very carefully it's rigorously defined and rigorously kind of like set out to build on top of what has previously been shown to be true. But when I say shown to be true, I'm talking about within this particular logical kind of framework where you kind of like abstract things you find in the real world, such as, you know, you might find 15 oranges and another 15 oranges. And through this kind of magic of abstraction through arithmetic, you can kind of quickly work out how many oranges there are in total. But the reason
that it's an abstraction, Dr. Wright, is because if I said, hey, I have an infinite number of oranges, and if I subtract an infinite number of oranges to give to you, I still have an infinite amount of oranges, and now you have an infinite amount of oranges.
So the statement that you've made is true, as long as we're talking about countable, like the countable infinity, or even, as long as you only give me the countable infinity, I think that should be fine. What I mean, the abstraction is that I think that sometimes there is this idea that you can take a mathematical concept that you prove, quote unquote, and believe that that has anything to do with the real world. So when people say 1 + 1 = 2, I don't take that as a truth of the world. I take that as a provable statement within the abstract framework of mathematics. Now, is this anything other than just a set of rules that we've written down? You can argue that no, mathematics is just a set of rules you've written down. However, those rules that you've written down, if you kind of follow and you turn the handle, they are incredibly good at being able to describe the physical world. So you can do stuff with them that you can't do without them. So if you want to work out, if you want to land on the moon, if you want to, understand, understand the likelihood of rolling dice, if you want to fly an aeroplane, all of these things.
Bake a cake.
Yeah. Now, all of these things rely on, if you want to estimate the dipole on an atom, it works out when you use mathematics to turn the handle. Now, there are other ways of doing it, right? You don't have to use mathematics to turn the handle. You can have superstition, and you can just, read tea leaves if you wanted to. However, I'm allergic to this idea of anyone equating a mathematically proved statement within the language of mathematics as anything having as it being true, in the same way that we would say that it's true that today's Saturday, because it's an abstraction. And I don't think abstractions can be proven true outside of their kind of their own language. So it's mathematically true, or it's mathematically defined that 1 + 1 = 2, but it doesn't have a deeper truth. Or at least
with that said, Lou, as a teacher, I'm not in the business of teaching truth. I am in the business of teaching what is useful to the students for life and living. So when I teach 2 + 2 = 4, it is so that I can ultimately get them to where, if they own a house at some point, they can change the carpet and figure the area of the room and know exactly what they need to buy. Right. So I'm not necessarily in elementary school and middle school teaching them things that are the most true. That's not my goal. But my goal is to teach the most useful things for them to live. And live well.
Yeah, but talk about carpet, right? You can work out very quickly mathematically how much carpet you need given the size of the room. It's it's incredibly convenient that it always works. And as a result, it's useful. But I wouldn't necessarily ever say that, you know, sometimes people get into like philosophical discussions when people, so if you go right the way back, people thought that, so certain civilizations had the, when they had the numbers, when they kind of decided that they would start calling things, having unique names for the numbers, some places just started out with, you know, one, two, and many. Now, those places didn't progress very fast scientifically, because you don't have, if you don't have a well-defined way of multiplying many by many and dividing it, you can't, you know, you can't build buildings very well. But the first thing you do, right, is that you start with the what we call the natural numbers, which are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and they go up as far as you like. And people then started having an argument about, well, what about zero? You know, someone tried to introduce this concept of zero. Go on.
I'm going to interrupt you 1 second, because if you remember 5 years ago, probably today or tomorrow or something, you and Ben sat in the Rio Hotel arguing about the number zero. Do you remember that?
Perhaps. But there was this idea of what the hell is zero? So, well, zero is just, you know, one less than nothing. And I said, but that doesn't even make any sense. And I can understand from an argument of, well, if you've decided to call the number of things this abstract concept, then having none of them, it's not quite the same thing, right? Because one banana is one banana, one orange is an orange, but zero bananas and zero oranges doesn't feel like a physical thing that can exist. But eventually, you know, within mathematics, you need to have this zero defined and well behaved in order to kind of make progress. And very quickly, what you end up doing is that you end up running into the negative numbers. And the negative numbers, if you thought you had a problem with zero, then you're certainly going to have a problem with negative numbers, because all of a sudden you've got minus one apple. Now, actually, in today's society, I think we get more comfortable with negative numbers because we have debt. And I think it's really because of debt that we get quite happy to deal with this, because it's not like negative one banana. It's that I owe you a banana and you're going to come around and take my TV if I don't give it to you. So we've got used to like the negative numbers, but they're very, at their core, they're very kind of like they're an unusual concept. And certainly people had big problems with this concept of, you know, negativity in accounting system when it was first introduced. And then you roll into the fact that you end up with, you know, non-integer numbers, so and a half and stuff. To be honest with you, that less inconvenient, because you can always consider them as you can always rescale the rationals away. So the idea of a half is just, you know, it's just half of what one is. So people got relatively comfortable about that. But you run into the irrationals, which when you're explaining an irrational to someone, that's a bit weird. And within mathematics, you also flow onto things like, you know, complex numbers, which is when you start taking the square root of a negative number and you end up not within the number line as it is, but within the number plane. And none of these things, you know, I have yet to meet someone that can tell me that complex numbers are legitimate, as in they kind of exist in the way that you would imagine like 1, 2, 3 exists. But they're absolutely needed to do any high level maths or electronics or computer science or anything like that. And it's at that point you really have to ask yourself, have you really set something up that you are that you're taking from the natural world, or are you just setting up a set of rules that happen to describe the natural world very well, even though they might not have analogy, or they might not be transferable across? And I've become very comfortable with this idea that look, just consider this to be a set of rules. We'll make progress in that sphere, both on the mathematics, then we'll take what we learned in the mathematics and apply it to the physical problems that we see in the world. And, you know, so far that it's doing a pretty decent job at being able to explain the phenomena that we see, with of course the caveat being that there's so much more that we don't know yet. Dude, let's get back to the episode. No one comes
well,
for this.
I have something. If we're interested at this point, Genevieve, my daughter is here. She's my 4-year-old. Genevieve, you watched Star Trek today, didn't you?
Yes.
What did you think of Star Trek today? What did you think of the episode?
I liked it.
What did you like about it?
I liked that they axed the skin off of the robot.
Wow, you are. That's weird. Why did you like that?
Because I liked it.
Okay. Thank you for your input. Have a good day.
A girl doesn't have to explain why. You just have to accept.
It is a cool scene, though.
It is a really cool scene. She's our morbid kid. Like, the other night, I was joking around with one of my kids, and I was like, I said something like, your head is gigantic. If we put your head on Genevieve's body, like, that was what you looked like when you were her age. You know, your current head. I don't think your head's grown much since you were her age. And we were all joking about that. And she was like, let's do it. Let's do it right now. We'll cut both of our heads off. And it's like, wait, you're crazy. Like, stop. And she's 4. Like, so what do you expect? But, yeah, no, she likes that kind of stuff. And she certainly liked the flashy lights and the makeup. It was really good.
All right. I might be completely wrong here, but I think it's really good, really well done. I like the way they look. I think that the makeup holds up, you know, 20 odd years later, or more than 20, nearly 30 years later. And I'm sure you can see through it a little bit, but I always enjoy seeing this. And when I saw that scene and how it kind of, you know, the kids were watching it as well, everyone kind of has the same reaction, right? Everyone thinks, whoa, what's going on there?
Okay. All right. Did I lose you guys?
No, we're here.
It just all of a sudden dropped out. Okay, so Data's got this this rock, I guess you could say, or whatever it is. It's I've lost where I was, but this thing he's holding up, if you looked at it, did you notice it maybe it looked like a comm badge in reverse, like turned around?
You're talking about the radioactive thing that he's holding.
Yes.
Like overlaid some junk with.
It kind of looks like it's a comm badge turned around, but
no, you're right. I never noticed that.
But so they're saying this radioactive thing is making everybody sick. Just is it because they touched it? They were in the same room with it, or what?
It seemed to be touched on this, and that's relatively similar to how it happened in the real world, I believe. Like, this is. You know, I've been watching a couple episodes of that Marie Curie radioactive kind of thing, and my wife and I have watched a couple of episodes of this 1601 doctor show from the BBC. And when they were first figuring out radioactive stuff, this kind of stuff that would happen. Like, it wasn't this weird, like, bubbly thing, right? But it was, you know, the guy who was learning about X-rays, like, his hand shriveled up because he would be handling it with his bare hands. And radioactive materials will legitimately, like, they'll ruin you.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And I don't know how well known it is, but you know, Marie Curie did die of radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
So this is I don't think it happens this quick, right? Of course, you don't exactly know what quote unquote radiation this is, but it feels like it's kind of a, you know, actual molecule decay rather than like gamma rays. It's going to like, you know, burn you and give you lesions.
Right. Well, Garvin is the first one to get sick, and of course our good doctor is trying to diagnose what's going on. And she says, what does she say? She gets out a magnifying glass and she assumes that his fluids in his body has overheated. So open the window and give some herbs. Herbs, not herbs, Lou. What do you think of that diagnosis? His fluids in his body have overheated.
But we still do stuff like this today, right? Like, we're always just approximating what we think it might be at that level. So she's just able to look at him outside, right? So, like, I had a hamstring tear last year. I went to kick a soccer ball, did a full split. I'm a very large man. I'm not meant to do full splits. And my hamstring ripped. It was a tier 3 rip is what I ended up thinking, though I never went and got it tested. But I went to the doctor and he stretches it out, does a few things and says, you know, I can't tell anything from here. Right. But he could have absolutely said, oh, yeah, this is, you know, a blood vessel pop because I see some bruising and it is whatever else, because he's just looking on the outside and equating it, approximating it to other things that he's seen or knows. So this is, I don't think that this is crazy on her part. Like, she's seeing this. She could never have even guessed that it would be radiation poisoning in any way, right? Like, there's just no way. She's never interacted with that before. This is from a thing that fell to her planet that they've never interacted with before, right? So she was equating it to what she's seen before, and it looked like something that maybe she had seen before or read about before or whatever else, and is giving the treatment that she would give for that, would be my argument.
Okay. And she also says that wood has fire in it. Is that what I got from her?
So wood has earth. Wood has earth in it.
And, I thought she said wood has fire in it. That's why it burns, because it has fire in it.
Yeah, what description? What modern day description do we teach kids on for this, for example? Because I doubt, you know, we're not telling them. We're not telling them that everything is made up of, subatomic particles at the quantum level, right? We're not talking about, you know, quarks and how they have, you know, their spin and the rest of it that gets formed into, like, you know, larger blocks. We at some point, we do make simplifications. Was she not just really saying here that things either are solid, liquid, or gas, and then things are combustible, which is, you know, if you think about fire, I always get kind of slightly fascinated by fire, because if you do think about, you know, solid, liquid, and gas in terms of that's the world that we know of, and that's the state of matter. Fire is a bit of an odd one out, right? You can easily convince yourself that you're seeing something that isn't part of that usual description. You know, the idea of the flames in particular. So I think I'm being generous maybe to the episode, but I very much kind of saw that as basically their description of the three states of matter plus fire. And wood indeed is combustible. Lou, you there?
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Had a medical issue, right? It happened here. My daughter got sick, and she's like, can I take a quick shower? I'm like, hey, as long as you get that lever up quickly, because they're going to hear that water run through that microphone. But anyway, we're good. And if I can still hear it, so if I can hear it, I know this microphone's picking it up. So sorry, guys. Yeah, no, had a little mishap. She's pregnant.
And it sounds like you're on the bridge of the starship is all it is. You're good. You should have it running the whole time you do every podcast.
You know, so, I actually did that one time. I put the background sound of the Enterprise in on the entire show. I had never heard anybody say it was bad. I never heard anybody say it was good. I never heard anybody say anything about it. But
so I did that whenever I did 10 Forward, Lou. I put the bridge sound and bar sounds, like the clinking of glasses. I put both of those in the background of every single bar episode that I did of 10 Forward.
That's funny. James, go ahead.
Did you just say your daughter's pregnant?
Yes.
Okay, I'm not aware of this.
Oh. Oh, James, hey, my daughter's pregnant.
Well, congratulations. You're going to be a granddaddy.
Yeah, finally at 52. Yeah.
That's
there's,
good.
Well, it is. It is good, except for the guy is a complete Nimrod. I believe Archie Bunker would have called him a meathead.
Mm. So, well, you can't do much about that now.
I can't do anything about that now. I'm not even going to go any further onto that. But anyway. So Deanna sees Dr. Crusher on the bridge and says, hey, I want to try that as well. But she's got to pass the test. It's easy peasy. She has to pass the test, and she keeps failing. Do you think Riker just gave her the clue? I'm sorry, I can't let you do that. My first priority is to the ship.
Okay, no. So I notoriously hate Riker. I think Riker is correct in this. He is serious. His first duty is to the safety of the ship, and he is, you know, he's not budging down, and he's obviously keeping, you know, the secret hidden away in his head, because obviously we do know that Troy is a telepath and should be able to read him like a book. I think Riker's very good in this. And I actually like the fact that they keep going on. It's brought up that Troy isn't the most like technical person in the world. And that she has, I can't remember what she refers to, but she finds it hard to distinguish her, you know, quantum singularity from whatever else jargon that they threw out there. And I like that, because what they do is that they specifically push back against the fact that that's, you know, although that's important, that's not the most important thing for command, which I agree with.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, but she does eventually, all she needed was to get that one piece, send Geordi to his death, and you get a promotion. I can live with that. So now it's time to, is it time to go find Data or what? How much have I missed before they come down to the planet to find Data?
Who?
Riker and Troy.
You've missed about three acts.
Exactly. I don't know where we are, so you're going to have to take over, since for some reason I'm missing it here.
Well, I mean, so if we want to, by the way, if we want to just wrap up the storyline with Troy, I think that you know, we're joking here about sending Geordi to his death, but fundamentally, it's, you know, being able to make the hard decision in a kind of in a quote unquote no win situation, right? It's, you know, you have to think of the wider good in order to be able to protect the ship. Now, I've always kind of considered these situations, though, when, you know, if everyone on the ship is there to protect the entirety of the ship, there is a part that I kind of feel that when Geordi was ordered, he should have just, like, delegated it to his ensign. Is that something that's allowed, or does it have to be the chief engineer that goes and tries to, you know, goes into the engine room?
That's a good question.
And you'd be doing some crass mathematics, right? At that point of like, who can do this job with the least detriment to the ship, right? Like, we might need our chief engineer in the future. We won't need, you know, sub assistant 12 on deck 14, who can literally only do this one thing.
And it's a good thing that I mean, Data wasn't in the holodeck, right? Because it would have been very easy for her just to send Data, because Data's potentially not gonna die, or it's an easier an easy out in this case.
Well, could Ensign Joey actually do the job? Does he know what to do, or is Geordi the only one who really knows the system the most? Or could Geordi take 5 minutes and tell him, okay, this is what you do, Joey. You go in here, you see this thing right here, you pull this lever, you push that button, and then you die. So, got it? Go. Could he do that, or would it have to be Geordi that has to do it?
I think that it was specifically set up so that she had to choose the person that she had a personal relationship with. I think that, you know, he made it so that Askins and Joey, because it's a test, right?
Yeah, it would have been really unfair if every single command officer in the fleet had ordered Geordi, and specifically Geordi, to die, rather than it being like context specific.
If he wanted to make it easier on her, he could have just put Barclay in that spot. Like, she'd have gladly sent Barclay and his sexual harassment self down there.
Ah, yeah, fit up. All right.
I'm going to solve two problems at once, Barclay. Get in there. That's an order.
So on the Albatani, the USS Albatani, when that ship's personnel has to take this command thing, the solution is every time you send Geordi the Forge. Who's Geordi the Forge? Well, he's a chief engineer on the Enterprise, and he's unfortunately the one we send to die every time. He's like Kenny on South Park. He dies every time we do this simulation. Maybe. Okay, so they do. Another part was Crusher. Crusher and Wrecker that go down to the planet, and they look for him, and they run across.
That's way, way, way beyond where we are.
You said we could end it here with the.
No, so we could end the Troy saga.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let me go on.
Yeah, no. So I was gonna, you know, one thing we should be clear of that you know, Data. I mean, we haven't made it completely clear that Data brings in some radioactive material into the village. He ends up selling some of it that he thinks is that can be used for jewelry to the local blacksmith. They end up starting. People start to get ill, right? And it's not just the people that he's close to, but the people around the village. I really like this because it puts Data into a position where he ends up having to try to fix the situation. So he's got the extreme magnification microscope. He's kind of like set up a little bit of a lab in his own in his house. But the thing that I like about this is that he's doing this at the time when the village is turning against him. And I think that that's a. By the way, I have to say I've never read Frankenstein. I do not know whether that is something that has been basically picked out of Frankenstein or not, but I like that you have that threat come in. And when my kids were watching it, they were really, you know, really worried for Data's safety, because you know that Data is in trouble. You know that the village is not, for want of a better word, enlightened enough to understand that he's not the cause, and he's very much under threat from pretty much, you know, halfway through this episode as people start getting ill. And it's a bit of a race against time to find the cure, but I really like the work that that they do to kind of like set up the kind of like the, you know, the anxiety that you have as you know that Data might not make it as the village turns against him.
But he does he has a solution, and they still hit him with that spear, and it they think it kills him. What do you think made hopefully I'm not jumping ahead too far. What do you think made them bury him right there in the town square?
I can't remember the So people find out that there's something up with him, right?
Yes.
Because he gets attacked at the end. He gets disfigured as well before that, and they like realize that he is something else. I suppose the question is, okay, you're asking why they burying him in the town square rather than kicking him out of the village and burying him on the mountain somewhere because they might be still afraid of the body kind of thing.
Something like
once
that.
once they realize that he has done such a good thing for them, I imagine they would want to commemorate it.
Oh,
but how long do they remember it? I mean, how long was he down there? That's the thing that gets me.
So I always did think that there was a slight redemption of the Data character of, you know, from the village's perspective, I think that there were enough people that knew that he was A, working on the cure, B, was able to actually put the cure into the water. You know, he also had cured the other guy right before before the final act. So I'd like to believe that, you know, after the madness in the night when he actually ended up getting killed, that they kind of came to realize that actually, you know, he wasn't the enemy. He was trying to do, you know, to do good. And I have to say, I think it's really good that they do kill Data in this episode. It wraps the story of Data meeting the village. It wraps it up in a really nice way. There's no kind of a, you know, there's he doesn't have to leave them. Everyone has kind of moved on. Everyone has acknowledged that they killed him. Everyone, you know, they've buried him and they've all moved on. And it allows them to have a complete circle on their story on the planet. And then obviously we cheat by beaming up the body and turning him back on once we're on the Enterprise, ready for next week's episode.
Really? Okay. Well then, what else am I missing, James? Help me, because I'm lost here.
No, I don't think we're missing that much. Chris, anything?
Oh no, actually, there is something I want to mention. So now that Deanna did pass the commander's exam, Deanna tells Data that she's now his boss, or she now outranks him. And I'm thinking, that can't be true. He's a second officer. Now, is he the third officer and she's a second officer? How does that work? But, you know, Data didn't correct her, so it's almost like he believed it's true. Yes, sir. How's that?
No, but that's fine, right?
Playing around.
No. So Deanna outranks him, but Data holds a more senior position within the command, line of command. That's all.
Oh.
In the same way that Crusher outranks him.
That's true. Crusher would. Yeah, okay.
And Nog outranks O'Brien by the end of the S9.
Everybody outranks O'Brien. Especially since they're not sure what his rank really is, so it's okay. All right, then. So Data's turned back on. He remembers who he is now, so we're good. All right. Good. So now it's time to rate this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. So, Chris, you're the guest of honor. Why don't you start us off?
I'm going to go completely off course here.
No way. I can't believe it.
Everything that I've said here doesn't matter, because this is a 5-star episode. If you were to take a moment and look up why Captain Picard was not in this episode, you would find out something special about the reason that he was absent, except for the one scene here.
Is that on...
You see, Jean-Luc Picard had taken some time off. He had taken some time off to film one of the greatest things ever put to film, A Christmas Carol, his one-man show. This show got placed onto DVD and put on TNT and is a perennial watch at my house. So just for the gift that this episode gave me of that show, that movie, it has to be 5 stars. It has to.
Okay.
Also, it's really close to 5 stars in and of itself. It's a really interesting episode. I think it contains some things that I absolutely bristle against, as we went into many meandering things, talking about the different things that kind of I bristle against. But overall, this is a really, really good episode. It's a fun episode. Kids can watch it with you. Your grandmother could watch it with you. If we're talking episodes of TNG that just kind of get at the heart of what TNG, I think, is, this is one of those episodes. So even without the wonderful fact that this is one of the episodes that allowed for a thing that I really love and cherish every single year. It is also a good example of what Star Trek can be, especially the next gen. So, 5 stars.
Oh, all right. Okay, how about you, James? And while he was talking, I actually am looking at the preview for A Christmas Carol. So, yes, I do want to see this. I'd never seen it before, so that's going to be interesting to watch. James?
Hey, I love this episode. I'm a big Data fan. I like all the Data episodes. I'm not that keen on the next Data episode, if I'm honest. I like this one. You know, it places Data in his most innocent status, right? They basically hard reset Data, and he comes with nothing other than, you know, I think it was mentioned in Insurrection. It's like, he didn't know. You know, the only thing he knew is what his moral subroutine. You know, that's all he had. That's all that he was acting on. And I kind of feel we get a very similar Data in this episode. He is, you know, is as pure and as naive as he ever can be. I like this episode a lot. I like the Data centric. That's always great. I like the story that's told here in terms of he starts having to figure out that he's causing damage and he has to fix it. He ends up doing so. It gets wrapped up really nicely on the planet. The Troy being promoted, I have no, you know, I'd like Troy being promoted. That's a good subplot that I think, like, adds, you know, it allows you to kind of, you know, pad out the story on the planet quite nicely. I have to say, by the way, that something we did not talk about is that there is a scene in this episode where Data is talking to the young girl. And Lou, you mentioned that the young girl is, you know, she's absolutely fine as an actor. There's nothing. You don't look at this and you think, oh dear, can you get away from the kids? You
know, they, I hear that a lot, you know, man. I hear that a lot. Oh, I hate the kid actor in this. I hate kid actors.
No, she does really well, and you know, she has scenes with people, and it's not, you know, we're not talking about like a master class or anything, but there's nothing wrong with any of the interactions. It's also got a lot of people on the planet, right, as well. And I like, you know, the guest stars they got for this episode were pretty good across the board. Anyway, there's a scene when they're talking about, I think it's the daughter's mother that's died, and she says, dad tells me that she's gone to a wonderful place where everyone loves each other and there's no death and stuff. And Data looks out into the sky and he's asked whether he believes such a place exists. And he says, yes, I do. And there's a clear implication there that he's at least from a viewer's perspective, we think that he must be referring to the Enterprise and the, to the future that we have built. And I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff. And I look at that and I think, yeah, that's good, you know. You can carry on down this road, you know, get better, get more advanced, love each other in society, and you know, soon we're going to have solved our problems, and you know, both social and technological / medical. I love this episode. I think this is great. I give it a full 5 out of 5. It's one of the gems of the seventh season, by the way. Sometimes people will mention that, you know, they don't like the seventh season for whatever reason, and I understand that there are issues around the seventh season with it not being as good as maybe, you know, series 6 and series 5. But you know, to write off the entire seventh season and just say that it's all good things is, you know, is missing so much. Last week's episode was great. I think this episode's great.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I really, you guys did a lot of talking about it. I really didn't have much on the final episodes. I agree. This is a good, very, very good episode. I'm with you guys on the 5. I was only joking about the synopsis. The synopsis sucks. I think they could give it a little bit better. But no, this really is a wonderful episode. You even see the little girl she cares about, Data, very much. He saves her life. He did risk her. He almost killed her, but he does save her life. He saves her dad's life. And when she talks about him, you know, pointing to there, she's right there. She looks very, very sad about it. So obviously Data touched her very deeply, and he's kind of like a child in his own right. So, yeah, I could see why that's possible. The doctor, yeah, I said she's ridiculous, but I did say I absolutely love the doctor. She is hilarious because, you know, everything she just gets it wrong. And I don't think the writers did that to be mean, Chris, as you may have said, not mean, but you used other words. I don't think they did it on purpose to be condescending. I think they just did it to be outlandish so that not only we could say, oh, come on, but Data, to sit in the back, you know, as an android, doesn't know he's an android, I suppose. He's sitting in the back of this classroom where all these little kids, he's at their level at this point trying to learn. But he can tell that doesn't quite make sense. I don't think it's that. No, I think you might be wrong there. Yeah, he probably shouldn't have did that. But I think think about it this way. He is at those children's level at this time. And he has knowledge somehow that that's not right. If one of those kids knew for a fact that what she's saying now is incorrect and here's why, they probably would have done the same exact thing. No, miss whatever, it's not correct. That doesn't make any sense. It's this one here. So I think it's kind of cute, and I think that's where they probably were coming from, is that Data was one of the children in that moment. So yeah, I absolutely adore the doctor. She's just so fun. We see her diagnosing Data. We see her at dinner. We see her as the teacher. What doesn't she do in this community? So, and all the while having the crudest of knowledge, she's hilarious. So I could do with lots more of her. Let's see here. You know, I guess the whole angry mob situation, they get sick and it has to be the new guy who did it. Well, in this case, it was the new guy who did it. But I don't know, the whole village ganging up on him and then spiking him through the back only to have sparks fly out of his body. That's interesting. So how did they go on with life after Data was sparking in front of them? Who knows? We'll never know. So, no, I do like this episode. It is it's not the highest five. This isn't yesterday's Enterprise five. So, but it is a good quality piece. So, I'm with you guys. Did I trick you again?
Yeah, I was not expecting.
Yeah, I will see, you know, try to top you off once in a while and see what happens. So, okay, so that brings us to the end of this episode. And James, in 3 days, as you know, I am leaving. No, in 2 days, I am leaving. 3 days, I'm leaving to go to Las Vegas. And I'll send you updates. I haven't decided what to do yet with the convention. I do see that they do have daily rates, but the daily rates seem kind of high, and I can't find an actual schedule of who's on stage at what day and what time.
Yeah, they're not they'll be released like on Tuesday or so.
Okay.
So they don't release that until later. But I am still astonished that I'm physically not allowed into your country yet. it's been you know, over a year now. Hopefully next year things will work out, and I will be able to come across. It's so strange. And I saw that you flagged up all of the people that had cancelled. I mean, a lot of them, I mean, some of them are going to be also foreign, right? So I think Marina Sirtis lives in London nowadays, and I'm sure some of the, you know, the English actors, that are potentially stuck on the other side of the world.
That's true. You know, I didn't think about that. So yeah, you're absolutely right. On some of them, that makes sense. The others that say, you know, for professional reasons or per professional obligations is what they say, that they're not able to attend. Does that mean they scheduled to attend and then found something better? So they have to do that.
Always. So yeah. We've got a Star Trek convention in London in October, I think it is, or it might be November this year. And every year, Jonathan Frakes is scheduled to attend, and every year so far, I think every single year he's pulled out at the last minute because he gets a directing gig at on some TV series. Yeah. So it's typically that, at least for Frakes, it is.
Yeah. Okay.
I can't imagine there are many people, actually working, or maybe I'm wrong. I saw that Nichelle Nichols had pulled out, for example, and I doubt that's because of work. But whatever people wherever people find themselves in, it's obviously going to be it's a particularly hard year this year.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll send you some. Messages. I'm not exactly you don't go to Facebook. I can't send text messages international. I don't even know how that would work. So the only thing I've got is Skype. Maybe you can
You could do it on WhatsApp as well. WhatsApp.
WhatsApp?
What do you not have WhatsApp in the US?
WhatsApp?
Yeah, WhatsApp.
WhatsApp?
Yeah, it's something that WhatsApp my wife got me onto a couple of years ago. But basically, the only thing it is, it's basically just it's messaging through it's messaging over data rather than over cellular, so you can actually send pictures. That's really what it's there for.
What was the app you said, Doc?
WhatsApp. WhatsApp is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's owned by Facebook.
Is it? Hmm. Well, send me your screen name on there if you would on text or instant message or Skype, and now
okay it's attached to what it's attached to phone numbers, but I'll send you that.
But okay, so I would put in your plus zero something or another to get to you.
Lou, we haven't quite finished the show yet.
Okay.
Yeah, don't put the dog's number out on the line, man. Don't tell the internet.
Hi, James. Hi, you don't know me. I'm a listener of yours. Why do you stay with Lou? And, you know, what's your answer? Well, at this point, what better have I got to do? So, anyway. All right. Okay, good. I got that. All right. So, that's what I'll put in.
That's on Messenger? Right. Sorry, go ahead.
Whatever. No, I got that's it.
The show. Bye, guys. Love you.
Oh, you're so sweet. All right, we'll talk to you next time. So everyone join us next whenever as we review episode number 17, and that's going to be Masks.
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 Are you going to talk about the book as well?
What book?
There was an early TNG novel called Masks. Are you also going to review that?
No, we are not.
I'd
be surprised if we actually even reviewed the episode, in complete fairness.
Well, I haven't yet. I know it's stupid. I remember that part, but yeah, I have trouble. I think Data puts a mask on or whatever the case is. I'm going to just stop there because, we'll be pleasantly surprised next week. I have I got two guests on, so we'll see if they're available. And Colin's one of them, so we're gonna have to get better at this by next episode. So, all right, guys, thank you. Thank everybody, you. Take care and good night.
Okay, good night.
Yeah, goodbye.
Okay, I've got to press the button to stop recording. Click.